TD News. I'm Dave McGrath. 8:10. The morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2020. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackanddrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show. I'm Gregory Berg. For the next few minutes, we're going to be talking about a book that is going to speak, I think, very directly to the hearts of many people listening. That is for adult children who find themselves in the position of being a caregiver for their own parents. That might be your story or the story of somebody you know, and it might be your story and on one end of the transaction or the other. That is, you might be the adult child giving the care. You might be the aging parent receiving the care. But even if this is not part of your own story at the moment, it very likely might be down the future. And even for somebody for whom this is not their own reality, it is still a very compelling thing to think about. The book at hand is called I'll Be Right There, A Guidebook for Adults Caring for Their Aging Parents. And it is the work of someone who is very much experiencing this reality for herself. Her name is Fern Pessin. And back in 2016, she essentially took up stakes from where she was living and working in the Northeast and moved to Boca Raton, Florida, to be close to her mother and her father, to whom she still gives care to this very, very day. And she has taken many of her own personal experiences as well as relentless research that she has done on the topic and put together this book that is really a workbook as much as anything, designed to help others who find themselves in this position. And the statistics show us that tens of millions of adult children are caring for their own parents. And this book may very well be a very helpful resource indeed. It is from Publish Your Purpose Press, again titled I'll Be Right There, A Guidebook for Adults Caring for Their Aging Parents. Fern Pessin, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
So describe, first of all, your personal and professional life before 2016, when you found yourself compelled for various reasons to move yourself to Boca Raton, Florida, and to be close to your parents. Describe, first of all, your life before that.
Okay, I was a nonprofit fundraiser, so my life was filled with running events and programs for animal shelters, for cancer care. I worked with a lot of variety of charities to run events raising millions of dollars. So very, very busy. I love what I did. I was also a part-time pet sitter because I love animals, and a part-time writer because I have a passion for writing. And my father was diagnosed with Alzheimer's and was getting worse, and my mother is a cancer survivor. We realized as a family, that going back and forth to Florida as snowbirds was probably not going to happen. And I moved to Florida to make sure that they had support, because otherwise they wouldn't have done it. And so that's my story.
Do I remember correctly that you have siblings?
I do. I have a brother and a sister that live, both of them live in Dix Hills, New York, about a mile from each other.
Hmm. I wonder if you could just take us inside kind of that conversation which took place, because I know that that can sometimes be one of the most complicated matters. That is, when we're talking about multiple siblings and this pressing need for a parent or both parents to receive sort of closer attention, that you have various siblings, any one of which might or might not be in varying degrees able to step up for such a responsibility. If it's not too personal a question, I just wonder how you and your siblings kind of handled this moment, in a sense, amongst yourselves, and what your advice would be for other siblings who have to take up this complicated question.
Yes, this is a huge issue. In most families, there's one person that it just sort of falls on and become the designated primary caregiver. And in our family, when we looked at the wellness of my parents, the cold weather, the fact that my mother was having difficulty walking, and we thought, you know, with snow and ice and whatever, it wasn't really going to go well. And the fact that my father started to not know where he was when he was driving meant that if they were living alone and still driving and in bad weather, perhaps, it wasn't going to work. So my sister has a husband and children. She has a business that really is focused in New York. My brother is the CEO of a company he owns in New York. He has a wife and stepchildren. So I'm single, and I have the kind of career that is project-oriented. So we figured, okay, this makes the most sense. And it's not always optimal. And so I looked at it, I tried to look at it with a positive, you know, I don't have to deal with winter anymore. Yay. I'll go to Florida. And I thought that I would still be able to work in Florida, but be close to my parents and provide the support, because they were still very independent, and they still are somewhat independent. But when I got down here, my father had crashed his car into somebody on the way down, totaled the car, arrived here and said, I'm not driving again. Mm. And my mother, with her perceptions and her ability to concentrate, was greatly diminishing. So I became their primary driver. And my sister and brother have always been very supportive. Whatever you need, Fern. So we worked it out, and this is what I recommend for other people. People can do what they can do, so take advantage of that. My brother's an IT tech kind of guy, and he handles all of that for my parents. So when we needed to install a camera in the living room to make sure that we could see if my dad fell, my brother handled all of that. If there's research to be done, if there are, you know, what I call toys to make life easier, he does that from wherever he is. My sister is wonderful at doing research, and she can help by, like, when we needed hospital beds for my parents so that the beds could be lifted by electronics, she did all that research and arranged for the delivery. And so it's not that they're not helping. They're just not here every day. They're not driving my parents to doctor's appointments or all of that. And we agreed that I would keep up with them with communication, because if, you know, God forbid something happened to me, what happens to my parents? So pretty much in the beginning, it was several times a week. Then it became once a week. Now it's as needed. I write a report by email to my siblings and let them know everything going on with the apartment, with my parents, with me, what my schedule is. And they come down as often as they can to give me respite, to let me take a weekend off or a week off or something like that. So they are working out the schedule so that every other month somebody's here to let me go do my thing, to let me share me with the world, if you will, without my parents around.
You are so fortunate, and I think, you know, you convey this pretty well in your book, that there are plenty of people who do not find themselves in this situation. I mean, not that most people, I don't think anyone would envy the situation that you find yourself in. But if someone does find themselves in such a situation, it is ever so much better when there are siblings who are fully supportive and appreciative. And that makes all the difference. And I love this idea of the report. I mean, somebody kind of at a glance might think, what are you talking about? Why would you write up a report? And yet it makes all of the sense in the world, not only for conveying important information, but also just for the sake of then you are, in a sense, not bearing this reality alone. I mean, in a sense, just by sharing this information on a very regular basis, you are, in a sense, not experiencing this gauntlet by yourself on your own.
Exactly. And I can't tell you how many conversations I've had with my sister and my brother where I just cried. Because they know my parents, and they know this isn't the dad that we knew. This isn't the mom that we knew. This is getting worse. It's going to keep getting worse. And they are good siblings in that they are doing exactly what you said. They keep telling me how much they appreciate me, and they know that this is hard, and let them know if there's anything they can do. Not everybody has that, but I think the scariest thing for me is now that I'm down here with my parents and my parents depend on me, what happens if something happens to me? I had a friend who was in her 40s and she had a stroke and she didn't know her husband. She didn't know herself. She lost her business because she wasn't prepared and she didn't let everybody know how to help her the best the way they could. So I'm making sure my siblings know. I know this sounds terrible probably, but I'm making sure my siblings know everything going on. So if something happened to me, they could pick up the gauntlet. They can take it and run with it and not feel like they were left in the dark. And I think that's the problem. A lot of long distance siblings feel like they're left out, and then it makes it harder to support the person who is the primary if they feel like they have no stake in it because nobody's telling them what's going on. It's hard. It's hard to want to help and not know how to help.
Absolutely. And to make that difference and to make it more possible is so important. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Fern Pessin, and we are talking about a book that she has written called A Guidebook for Adults Caring for Their Aging Parents. Fern Pessin in 2016 transplanted herself from the Northeast down to Boca Raton, Florida, to be close to her mother and father, and so she could give them the care that they needed. One of the things that is a bit complicated about your situation is that it is both of your parents requiring special care. Your mom as a cancer survivor, your dad contending with Alzheimer's. Talk for a moment about what this has been like, about both of your parents having significant needs and also, at least to some extent, needs that are different from the other.
Yes. My mother had cancer in her spine, so she has neuropathy in her foot, and it makes sometimes her foot drags, so she has some mobility issues. My father is lightheaded. He's I'm not dizzy. I don't have vertigo, but he's lightheaded, a little off sometimes, and he's prone now to falling. So my mother holds my father up. My father holds my mother up. The two of them walking are a sight to see, but they're there to support each other literally and figuratively. And for right now, as long as they have each other, they can still be independent living together. But the family all together made a decision, and my father agreed that it was time to move to a place where there was support available to them. So that has helped me and my siblings a great deal in that we could do that. And my parents now have an entire team of people running programs and events. So my mother, who's social, has something to do during the day, while my father prefers to be more to his own company. And that has helped. us, but my mother has what's called pseudo-dementia, which is she's signs of all the dementia, but it's because of stress of taking care of my dad. So conversations can get very kind of funky. We have repeat conversations, deadlines, schedules, doctor visits, what they said, medication management. All of this has become issues that we deal with on a daily basis. So it can be overwhelming to try to manage two other people's lives and health.
I remember you saying in the book that you entered this fray, shall we call it, with essentially no expertise. That is, you did not come into this having already been a licensed practice nurse or a therapist or any of the various careers that, in a sense, might lead very naturally into doing this kind of work, giving this kind of care to your parents. So, in a sense, you have had to become an expert even as you have been experiencing all of these challenges. What has that been like, and what has been most valuable to you in terms of learning all that you needed to learn in order to do this to the very, very best of your ability?
Well, that is so true. I got down here and thought I would have plenty of time to kind of acclimate myself and just be around for my parents. But I couldn't start working or do anything like that on my own because I was taking care of them, driving them, taking them to doctors, lawyers, all of those things to get the estate settled and or set up, however you want to call it. And it was really challenging. So immediately I got into a caregiver support group for children caring for their adults. And I met all these wonderful people going through the same thing I was going through. I found myself a therapist who had experience in working with caregivers. So I could turn to somebody because I was here alone. And it's really isolating. A lot of caregivers find themselves that feeling very disconnected with the outside world because it becomes your focus. This is all you do. So I did that for a while, learned a ton from doing that, and then read a bunch of articles, went online. There are caregiver support websites on there. I put a bunch of them in my book because I think that it helps to have articles and information, started collecting that, then realized that if at some point we needed to have a home health aide or a nurse in the house, I didn't know what I could expect from that. So I went, and not everybody does this. This might be a little crazy, but I went and took a class at a nursing school to become a home health aide. Not that I wanted that as a career, but I wanted to know what I needed to know to be able to take care of my parents. I wanted to meet other aides, know what I could expect from them. And secretly, I wanted to see if I could find somebody who my dad might be okay with because he doesn't want anyone in the house. He's a man. He doesn't need anyone in the house. And my mother couldn't leave the house unless I was here to be with my dad. So I found a guy there who was a handyman, and we hired him, so I knew he had all the you know, CPR and all of that kind of stuff. But he came in, and he was fixing things around the house. Every time my mother had to go out, Dennis was here. So my father was okay with that. He was okay with having a fix-it guy, but he wasn't okay with having an aide. So that it helped with that.
What would you say were the most valuable tools or the most significant information that you gained from that study as a home health aide? I mean, to receive that certification, I think that's one of the most intriguing things that you offer up in the book. When it comes to like nuts and bolts, tangible things, what would be one or two of the things that you were especially grateful for learning in the course of that?
Well, in that class, you learn everything about keeping, you know, aesthetics, keeping the clean and all the wound care stuff. You learn about medication management. You learn about how to move somebody that might have fallen or is having difficulty, how to support somebody. So when you're dealing with somebody who may or may not be able to get in and out of a shower or in and out of a bathroom, on and off a couch, those kinds of things, it's really helpful to learn how to not hurt yourself and be able to support somebody. There's other things that I learned in the process, like keeping a note by the door frame where people go when EMS would come in and take your parent or you, whatever, out. You can have a note with an envelope by the door that says your blood type, which hospital you want to go to, your medical history, and any things that they need to know in order to give your parents the best care possible, you know, insurance information, that kind of thing, the primary care doctor, emergency contact, all of that. So if you put that by the door, then when EMS comes, they just grab that and they have everything they need. Or put a phone on the floor if your parents are prone to falling, because they might not remember how to use that great smartphone you gave them that's in their pocket, but they can crawl to a landline phone, and that they will remember. So it's that kind of little things that I learned over time.
One of the choices you made with this book is to create it as kind of a manual, kind of a workbook. It even has worksheets in it. And it will probably remind some people of certain books that are created for new mothers, that kind of thing. How did it occur to you that it would make sense to put together a book like this in this sort of format?
Okay, so I went for, my sister came up, and I went away for a week to recover, you know, after a certain amount of time, you need to completely separate. So I went on a healthy, like, meditation, kind of eat healthy sort of a thing. And when I was there and talking to other people who were there, they kept saying, "Fern, how did you even know to do this? Give me the list. I need the list." And I said, "I don't have a list." They said, "Well, you got to make a list." So I started making a list of all the things that I had learned and all the things that I had done. 352 pages later, it's a long list. And I wrote it in a way, because other people don't have time to do all the things that I did. I recognize that a lot of caregivers are working full time while they're also taking care of their parents and supporting their parents. And if you go through the book and you can first look at the assessment section and figure out where your parents are, then you know how much of the rest of it. So it's a big book, but it's, you don't need to do all of it. You just have to figure out where your parents are and go from there. And the little things that you can do to keep your parents in their house longer and safer, those kinds of things are in there. So once you fill out the assessment, then you know next steps. Then you look for all your contacts so that you're not running around last minute. And that's what makes you stressed, all the not knowing how to do something. And that's why you say, "I'll be right there," all the time. Your mother calls you and says, The sink is exploding. What do I do?" And you're, "I'll be right there." You know, your father fell and he's got a cut. "I'll be right there." But if you have the resources to call and say, "Oh, I already know the plumber. I'll just call him and have him come over and then I'll be there." Those kinds of things that people don't think about. Or I live in Florida now and there's hurricanes. So do we know where the shelter is? Do we know where to go and get supplies? Are those things taken care of? So it's kind of like a schedule of what you need to know and when. And if you figure it all out before you actually need to know it, that's going to reduce a huge amount of stress. Plus, you can delegate. If you go through the book and you say, "Oh, I can give this to my sister who's out of town. I can give this to a friend, a family friend. I can give this to the, you know," and that takes some of the burden off you. So that's why I decided to do it this way. So people can reduce their stress by being prepared.
Well, and it's a very good example of when somebody is facing something that is quite overwhelming, it is very easy to just kind of get lost in the slog of that. And what you are suggesting is that if somebody can find the wherewithal to, in a sense, step away from it just long enough to do a bit of planning, that can make all the difference in the world. I mean, it is worth the time to do it because of all of the time and stress and maybe even heartache that you will be saving yourself from in the time that comes after. But one has to take the time to do this.
Right. For example, if your parent had a fall, wound up in the hospital, and they're under, looking for a fracture, this, that, or the other thing, and then they have to go to rehab, the hospital calls you and says, your parent is being discharged in 5 hours. Where do you want us to send them? So you imagine how stressful that is when you've got your life going on and all of a sudden you have to figure out which rehab to send your parents to, which one's covered by their insurance, which one is where their doctor is accepted. And you start making calls frantically because you've got 5 hours to go get your parent moved, or that you get somebody's coming home and needs a hospital bed because they're immobilized. Or a wheelchair? Do you know where to get it? Do you have a rental company that you've already scanned out and made sure the insurance is accepted and all of that? If you do that in advance, okay, thanks. I'll just call so-and-so, and it's done. Hmm. You see? Doesn't that make sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I want to make sure before we finish that we have a chance to talk about something that is beyond the nuts and bolts. And that is the fact that there is a very complicated emotional component to what we are talking about when there is this drastic reversal of roles, when a child is suddenly caring for their own parent, and matters of dignity and respect become far more complicated than they probably ever were before. What have you experienced yourself when it comes to this matter, and what is your advice for people who find themselves in this position in terms of preserving at least as much as possible the dignity of their parents as they find themselves in this really hard situation?
Yeah, I did a lot of hearing things like, you're not the boss of me. I'm your mother. You have to listen to me. I raised you. Those kinds of things. Because when you come at people with, you have to move, or you need to stop driving, oh, that's not good. that gets, what do they call it? The hackles raised. People get very agitated about that. So there's conversation starters you can have that make it a lot softer and a lot more respectful. It's still your parents. So there's that kind of a thing where you want to maybe suggest that we try a driving test. I've noticed some unusual things in your driving. Would you be willing to go through an evaluation? Okay, fine. Or if you have a neighbor or a friend that has gone through a situation, like I had a friend who spent $13,000 on a funeral for his father, and when he was cleaning out the house a few weeks later, he found a prepaid cremation. So now he's going to spend 5 years paying for a funeral that his father didn't even want. So he's got all this guilt about not doing what his father really wanted, and then a financial burden. Nobody wants that for their kids, and nobody wants that for their parents. So communicating on what are your wishes. I also recommend doing something. This 5wishes.org has a document that has these conversation starters. So I'll tell you what I want, and you tell me what you want. And that way, when we get to that place, it's what you've told me you want, and I'm giving you exactly what you've asked for. So it's respecting what the other person wants. Mm. But there's also a guilt that comes with being a child taking care of parents, because you get that feeling of, I don't want to do this anymore. How did I get myself into this? I hate doing this. And then my mother told me, she says, well, I think you're just trying to get rid of me so you can marry your father. Whoa. That is an unusual thing to say, Ma.
No
and
kidding.
That's what happened. Yeah, yeah. So it's things start coming out, and it can be very, very overwhelming, which is why having a caregiver support group or siblings you can talk to or a best friend can really, really be, it's really critical to have that support network set up, because your parents are your parents, and you don't want to be their parent. You're supposed to know everything. You're supposed to tell me what to do. And here you are flipping the roles around. It's really hard.
Right. And I should think that when you know that you are fulfilling your parents' wishes, or what at least were their wishes, that in a sense, instills a level of confidence that as you're doing something that's hard enough as it is, but would be still harder if you're not certain if whether or not you are at odds with their wishes. But when you know that this is what they want or what they wanted, these are their stated wishes, I should think that really makes an emotional difference for the better for the caregiver.
Yeah, not only that, if you can get everybody in the family on the same page, again, we're back to talking siblings and parents, all on the same page, then you don't have fights. Because I can't tell you how many times I've heard siblings fighting over, no, Mom said she'd want this, so Mom would prefer that. I know what Mom wants, you know. And then I've had lawyers tell me that they can't do anything with people because the family's so busy fighting, they have to leave the room because they're arguing over what Mom or Dad should or shouldn't have or want. So if you can do it while everybody's still able to talk, and that's important, doing it before you need it, then you can ask, what would you prefer? My parents were sitting next to each other, and I asked them one of the questions in the five wishes, which is, towards the end, would you rather be in a hospital or at home or in hospice? And my mother just came right out and said, in a hospital. And my father said, at home. And my mother and father looked at each other like, what? Because they each thought the other one wanted the same thing they wanted. So you have to start that conversation so that you can say, look, I have this in the writing. Here's everything we discussed. I'm doing exactly what you want. And then your parents don't think you're trying to take over their lives because it's what they've told you they want. Hmm. So you're giving them respect to honor their wishes.
Hmm. Well, I can't tell you just how impressed I am with not only what you have accomplished in terms of giving care to your own parents, but then stepping beyond that to want to extend help to others who find themselves in this situation. And I think you've done a really commendable public service with this book, which again is titled I'll Be Right There, A Guidebook for Adults Caring for Their Aging Parents. It's published by Publish Your Purpose Press, the author Fern Pessin. Fern Pessin, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. Best wishes to you and to your two parents. And thank you again for being part of The Morning Show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The time is 8:43, and you're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's program, we're going into the Morning Show archives to replay a conversation that is strangely timely, given recent American activity in Iran and the interest which has been brought up about the killing of Osama bin Laden. Here is a book that deals very directly with that. The time is 8:44 here on WGTD. It's been my great pleasure to speak with highly regarded author Mark Bowden on several different occasions on The Morning Show. Actually, I think most recently about a rather lighthearted yet fascinating look at one of the most famous NFL football games ever played between the Giants and the Colts back in 1958. what a difference a different book makes. We are talking about something much weightier, much more serious, and every bit as fascinating. Mark Bowden's latest book, which is called The Finish, The Killing of Osama Bin Laden. And this book not only charts that dramatic series of events in which Osama Bin Laden at last was brought down, but also traces much of what Osama Bin Laden's life was like between the events of 9/11 and the time of his eventual killing. The book is published by Atlantic Monthly Press. Mark Bowden, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg.
Your book begins in somewhat surprising fashion, although I think it's ultimately quite effective. You begin the book with the events of 9/11 through the eyes of people whom we don't really think about in terms of where they were and what they were thinking and experiencing on 9/11. I mean, people like Barack Obama, years before he became our U.S. president. Can you tell us why you began the book in this way?
Sure. I see the death of Osama bin Laden is sort of the final chapter, in a sense, of a story that started on 9/11. And, you could argue that it actually started years before that, and I go into this a little bit in the book because, bin Laden had been trying to attack the United States for years before 9/11. But I think the game got very serious after 9/11, and the story that I tell is really about how the United States developed the capability to find bin Laden, and also how the special operations community honed its skills over hundreds, if not thousands, of missions in Iraq and Afghanistan to be able to pull off this, near-perfect raid that they did in May of 2011.
When you talk about what happened on 9/11 and what Osama bin Laden, in a sense, accomplished, you call it both his greatest achievement and his undoing. Explain how that event could be both of those things, in effect, for Osama bin Laden.
Sure. Bin Laden, of course, achieved a great deal more from his own perspective on 9/11 than he ever anticipated. I think his fondest hope was that, he would stage a spectacular attack on these American landmarks and that it would, horrify or shock the world. But, I don't think he ever anticipated that the attack would collapse the World Trade Center towers. So to him, that was, a tremendous achievement. And at the same time, it focused the energies and attention of the United States military and intelligence community on targeting him. And that really was the death knell for his organization. By the time he was killed, his organization had been decimated by years of very effective attacks by, both during the Bush administration and during the Obama administration.
Your book describes the life of Osama bin Laden through the course of roughly a decade, a decade in a sense in hiding and on the run, a life which ultimately shrunk to just a couple of rooms and to a very limited sphere of activity. Describe to our listeners essentially what the day-to-day existence of Osama bin Laden in hiding was like.
Well, for 5 years, he lived with three of his wives and about a dozen children on the upper two floors of this three-story house, which was basically windowless. They never left. He, other than to leave the house and take walks in circles around the inside of that compound, presumably for exercise, he never went anywhere. So he was living in determined hiding during those years, and his days were spent writing these long letters to his field commanders, trying to, spur them on and to direct the operations of Al-Qaeda. And I suppose just I imagine it's fairly complicated details of domestic life when you've got three wives and dozens of children.
And you paint the picture of someone who had very much lost control over other Islamic extremists. Particularly when he saw Muslims killing other Muslims, this evidently caused him great anguish. And you suggest he felt great frustration at being relatively powerless to sort of affect the course of events.
Yep. Well, his fondest hope was to inspire an extremist Islamist revolution throughout the Middle and Near East, where all Muslims would rally behind the banner of Al-Qaeda and create what he envisioned as a great Muslim nation or a single Islamic nation. And instead, you know, he found that these various organizations that use the name Al-Qaeda were becoming so indiscriminate in the attacks that they mounted. They were killing Muslims and alienating the very people who he had hoped would rise up and follow him. Hmm. And then, of course, when these revolutions began happening during the Arab Spring, they weren't motivated for the large part by Islamist extremism. They were popular movements against local dictators, often, you know, by young Arabs going into the streets, agitating for a greater voice in their own government and democracy. You know, I think that these things were, on the one hand, he was glad to see the toppling of these dictators, but on the other, I think he was very alarmed that his own vision was sort of being left behind.
As you put it so well at one point, Osama bin Laden could picture what must be done, but could no longer make it happen.
That's right.
Something that I think will be also, it was amazing at least to me, was that when you write at one point that there had been no scent of the Al-Qaeda leader for more than 8 years, ever since he had slipped away from the mountain outpost of Tora Bora during a botched siege by Allied troops. We really, in fact, had no idea where he was for the longest time. And I think a lot of us assumed that we maybe didn't know exactly where he was, but that we had maybe some rough sense, at least. You paint a picture of sort of a deeper, darker cloud of ignorance when it came to this matter.
Right. I mean, we knew, the CIA knew, that he had fled Afghanistan into the tribal areas of Pakistan. And, you know, so initially the assumption was, well, he's hiding somewhere in those tribal areas. But then as years went by and there was not a single sighting or report of him from anywhere in that region, it became apparent to the analysts that I talked to that he probably wasn't there, that it would have been hard for him to exist in those areas without there being some whiff of his presence. So they had pretty much concluded by the middle of the first decade of this, you know, century that he'd gone off, and they really had no idea where he was. And how they pieced together, you know, the things that led them to Abbottabad, to me, is the most fascinating part of the story.
Absolutely. I mean, it becomes a real detective story of sorting out just who is living in this strange-looking compound, what might be going on there. Ahead of that, you suggest, and you more than suggest, you report to us, really, that President Obama signaled sort of a new resolution, new resolve, when it came to pursuing bin Laden and finding him. And you say that it's not that search had ever completely been abandoned, but what sort of difference did it make when President Obama signaled sort of new resolve or new focus on this particular matter?
I think it had to have had an effect, and everyone I talked to at CIA and at the Pentagon agreed that, you know, even though the analysts working on this problem at CIA were never flagged, I think, in their efforts, it matters a lot whether at the very top of the chain, you know, this is the emphasis that's being put on the effort. I mean, the President Obama demanded monthly progress reports, and as I point out in the book, and no one in a large organization wants to be producing progress reports that show no progress. So it had to have had an effect, and there's no doubt that and President Obama has been very consistent, even long before he became president, in arguing that he felt the appropriate target for the United States was the top leadership of Al-Qaeda. And he did everything I think he could when he became president to shift the emphasis in that direction.
You tell us that once there was suspicion aroused that, in fact, Osama bin Laden and his family might be living in this sequestered compound, the question remained then of how can we be certain, and how much uncertainty can we live with, and what should we do about this? Explain why it was very crucial to be as certain as possible, and why just going in there in sort of full-scale attack was an option that had to be weighed very carefully.
Well, because it meant, Greg, invading the sovereignty of Pakistan. They didn't want to alert the Pakistani authorities to their suspicions for fear that that word would tip off bin Laden in the compound if he was there. And so they had to basically decide early on that if they were going to take action, they were going to be doing it inside the borders of Pakistan without the permission of the Pakistani authorities. And the possible downside of doing that, given how important Pakistan is to our efforts in that region, was huge, even as far as potentially getting into a shooting war with Pakistan. So you don't entertain taking that risk very lightly. And so a key part of the calculation became, well, how certain are we, you know, that this is actually bin Laden in the compound? So it was a big gamble for the president to take. And when you look back at it, I think they tried very professionally, you know, to measure and weigh alternatives.
You suggest that the ultimate choice to do this by raid versus, for instance, just bombing the place, that one of the reasons why that choice was made was because of the very real possibility that valuable intelligence could be pulled from the compound, which would lead to further breakthroughs against the Al-Qaeda organization. To what extent, in fact, did that occur?
They did get a mother load of useful information, and we haven't heard for obvious reasons, all that they found. I got a chance to review a lot of bin Laden's correspondence in his final year, which was a fascinating portrait of how his mind worked and what his conditions were, including a letter he was writing 5 days before he was killed. I think that was a big, big part of why they did it the way they did it, and it proved to be a real useful haul.
It's an exciting book, and when one opens it up, they find a little errata slip that falls out, at least my preview copy did, in which you acknowledge some further details which have come to light since the publishing of your book, new details which will be fashioned into later editions. At any rate, it's a superb job. So is your next book about NFL football or weightier matters like the pursuit of Osama bin Laden?
I haven't even had a lot of time to think about what I'm doing next, but I do think it's going to be about something to do with the war in Vietnam. So I'm reaching a little further back in history, and I think it's going to be a weightier tome than one of my football books.
I've enjoyed everything you've written, Mark Bowden, and so enjoyed, if that's the wrong word, but appreciated the great work demonstrated in The Finish, The Killing of Osama bin Laden, published by Atlantic Monthly Press. Mark Bowden, thank you so much.
Thank you, Greg.
This interview was recorded back in 2012. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, my guest will be Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage, paying his monthly visit to The Morning Show to offer his thoughts on various issues of concern, including, of course, current tensions in the Middle East, among other issues that we will discuss tomorrow. Wednesday's Morning Show will include, among other things, a conversation with Nate Stamper, who is director of the current production at the Racine Theater Guild, namely the award-winning play On Golden Pond. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at our website, WGTD.org, and available as a podcast via Spotify, Google Podcast, or Apple Podcast. Be sure that you look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg in order to enjoy The Morning Show 7 days a week. Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2020. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack Andrea, a proud supporter of WGTD's Morning Show. This is WGTD HD.